Ladies and gentlemen, this is the second to last episode of the Sons of History podcast. Before you grieve yourself to death, don't. I'm Dustin Bass. My friend is over there, Alan Joaquim.
Yes, yes. Hello. Second to the last. This is kind of like the Puerto Rico parade of Seinfeld. You remember that episode? Did you see that one?
I've seen. Here's the thing with Seinfeld. It's so bizarre. I'm such a big fan, and yet I know that there are episodes that I've never seen. Uh-huh. But I think I have the final season. So, yeah, I had to have seen it.
Final season was okay. It was all right. I think it was time for them to call it quits. But when you say it's the second to last episode, I'm like thinking, yeah, that was when they're coming back from the beach and they're trying to get home on a Sunday and they come across the Puerto Rico Pride Parade.
Oh yeah, the ribbon? Is that the
those two guys were there because Kramer accidentally lit. Somehow a Puerto Rican flag guy caught on fire and he was trying to put the fire out, but those two guys saw him and they're Puerto Rican and they thought he was stomping on the Puerto Rican flag, and boy, that pissed off a lot of Puerto Ricans.
Yeah. Oh, that was those were a couple of good bit players on that show. They got canceled after the ninth season, right? Seinfeld was canceled?
Canceled? They weren't canceled.
I love it.
That was a good
day. So good.
Yeah.
Well, hey, man. This, ladies and gentlemen, this guest that we're going to be having on is one that I have looked forward to before the season began, when we had him scheduled. This guy, Julian Jackson, he is a phenomenal historian. He's out in the UK. So we are up early this morning to have him on. Not nearly as early as I had initially accidentally emailed about. I said, hey, I will see you at 9 a.m. your time, which would have been about 3 a.m. our time. And he's like, well, that's great for me. That's pretty early for y'all. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm glad you said something. I said, I meant 9 a.m. our time.
You know, I think 3 a.m. for us would have been better because, I got up way too early. And it's easier for me to stay up late. You know, just skip the Ambien. If I don't take Ambien, I'll be up till 4 or 5 in the morning.
Yeah, I'm the same. I'm sort of the same. Like, my bedtime routine is like 1:30, 2 a.m., you know, and then wake up around not right now, not in the eights.
Yeah, you know, back in my 20s, I would go out with my friends. We'd go clubbing to a place like Ocean Club, and I would get home probably around 4 a.m., and then I had to sleep for about an hour, showered, and went to work.
Isn't that the life, man?
Yeah, I got there by 8. In your 20s? And it was okay. I was fine. I was fine back in those days.
Now, you're able to do it.
Now, if some girl calls me up and says, hey, you want to come over? I'm like, you know, it's 1 a.m. I really, really would like to get some sleep.
Yeah, exactly. What is it? That's a Seinfeld episode when she's like, he said he has to get up early in the morning.
I don't remember that one.
They're like, oh, yeah, no. No man ever says they have to get up early in the morning. No, it's you. Well, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, we're going to bring on Julian Jackson. But before we do, if you haven't yet, I know it's the second to the last episode, but go ahead, subscribe, leave us a like and comment. If you're watching on YouTube, that would be great. Leave us a rating and a review if you haven't subscribed yet on podcast or Spotify or wherever you're listening. Those things are very helpful. And look, hey, we're still going to remain active with the Sons of History. We're going to be all on our social media stuff. We'll be posting on the constant on YouTube and Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, now X. Feel free to still engage. Hey, like somebody did the other day, shoot us an email and say how distraught you are that we're closing up shop. So it would be very, very kind. It's always great to hear from our fans.
Yeah, we're still going to do videos. So I know that that's something that we talked about. We've got like a ton of videos that we still need to get them out. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's still plenty of work to be done.
Yep.
So, and we'll do it. So, yeah, it's always, there's always something around the bend. The bend is there. Just because you can't see it doesn't mean it's not there.
Yep. And history grows by the day.
Ain't that the truth? Well, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, we're going to bring on Julian Jackson. Julian Jackson is the Emeritus Professor of History at Queen Mary University of London. He is a fellow of the British Academy. And here are some, he focuses on France, World War II France primarily. And so these are some words that I really can't say, but I'll interpret. He's a commandeur de l'Ordre des Palmes Académiques, which is the commander of the Order of Academic Palms. He is an officiel de l'Ordre de Lettres.
Dude,
so he's officer of the Order of Arts and Letters.
You're killing me here. Don't do that. You're gonna have a whole country hate us. So just
hey, man. Like no, that's my best French. Sorry. And I've been practicing a little bit over the last number of months. So that's actually pretty good. So yes, he's officer of the Order of Arts and Letters. His biography, De Gaulle, won the Duff Cooper Prize and Elizabeth Longford Prize. It's become really the standard biography of Charles de Gaulle, and was a New Yorker, Financial Times, Spectator Times, and Telegraph Book of the Year, the De Gaulle book. His book, France, the Dark Years, 1940 to 1944, was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, and his Fall of France won the Wolfson History Prize. We have with us to discuss his latest book, France on Trial, The Case of Marshal Petain, Julian Jackson, and I will tell you this, one of my favorite books of the year, no doubt, bar none. Absolutely fantastic. So without further ado, we're going to bring on Julian and we're going to have our discussion. We've got him on the line. Julian, how are you doing, my friend?
Very well, thanks. Great to be here. It's in the afternoon in England, early for you in the States, I think.
You are correct. You are correct. But you know what? Sacrifices must be made and they have been made. So yeah, no worries. I will say this, speaking of sacrifices. Actually, it's more in the lines of butchering. I tried to do the French version of your commander of the Order of Academic Palms and officer of the Order of Arts and Letters. Try to do the French version, but I will let you know I butchered that, but I did also give the interpretation or the translation of
right.
It.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just an FYI. But, yeah, it's fantastic to have you. Really have been looking forward to this conversation. And as was made pretty darn clear in my review of your book, that I very much enjoyed it and really just looking forward to having the conversation.
Great, me too.
I was going to let you know that I actually have a special interest in your work because my parents were born in what was then known now. What was then known as the French Mandate of Syria, and but they're Lebanese. The area that was carved out of where they lived was French Lebanon until it became independent a few years later. So, and my mother was born during the time of the British and Free French invasion of Lebanon, and so they could not record the actual date of her birth. So she was born on one day, but they couldn't register her birthday until about three weeks later. So that was all.
That must have been June 1941.
It was in that time period. Yes. So, Yes, so that was always a thing for me in terms of
it's interesting.
The history.
You're the second. I've done one or two other podcasts in America, and you're the second one where actually the one of the person who I'm talking to is interviewing has that sort of personal experience. I was interviewed by someone a few weeks ago whose parents were in France in 1942. So Jewish and managed to escape to America. I think through Spain and Portugal, and got to America, and he was born in America. So this story does link to lots of experiences of people, you know, alive today. Absolutely. Yes.
I'm assuming they were in the Vichy part of France.
They were in the Vichy part of France. Yes. Yeah. They were in the south, in Marseille.
Where that famous photo of that man was crying.
Remember yes, that? Yes, yeah, yeah. That which I think was, we don't quite, where the man is crying, and probably in Paris, but we don't know. I think he's just watching. He's watching the German troops arrive. We don't really know why he's crying, but it's the tragedy of the situation overall, I think, what it is. But
okay,
all right. Well, let's start with your work for our listeners. Who was Marshal Philippe Pétain, the hero and the villain?
Well, Pétain had been the the great French war hero of the First World War. He was a hero sort of on a scale that's almost unimaginable today. He had all the qualities of all the First World War general heroes rolled into one. So he was Marshal Foch of France, or Hindenburg of Germany, or you could say Pershing, United States, Haig in England. I mean, he really was the hero of heroes. And that's because he was associated with two really important events in the First World War. The first of those events was the defense of the fortress of Verdun in 1916. And that was really, it's rather similar. You hear a lot about Verdun today with the Russian-Ukrainian war, because this sense of thousands and thousands of lives being lost just to hold on for almost prestige as much as any strategic reasons to a tiny, what might not be important, but it becomes morally important. So Verdun was that on a hugely bigger scale. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people died in 1916. So Pétain was the man who defended successfully Verdun in 1916. And then in 1917, when there was a wave of mutinies in the French army, when it really looked as though the French army might collapse, Pétain was the man who put an end to the mutinies, partly obviously by having some ringleaders arrested and shot, but also, and more importantly, by realizing that it was fundamentally important to improve the conditions of the ordinary soldier. So better pay, longer leave, etc. And so he became not only the man who'd won the most important battle, but also the general who actually cared about the ordinary soldier. So in 1918, he is, you can't imagine what a hero is. He's also he just looks the part. He's extraordinarily good looking. He's women fall for him en masse. He's got a sort of nobility of bearing these piercing blue eyes, the silvery white hair. He looks 20, 30 years younger than he is. So he is this hero. So when in 1940, France this time is beaten, when the Germans invade in May 1940, there's a cataclysmic defeat. 6 weeks, the French army is routed. Not Pétain's fault. Pétain isn't in charge. Pétain's in retirement. He sort of is brought out of retirement, or comes out of retirement, first to be the to bolster the morale of the government. Then when France is beaten, he emerges as the sort of man who is going to take over, negotiate a peace, an armistice with the Germans, and be a kind of protector of the French in a completely new situation. So two, he's a heroic hero in the First War. He's the man who comes to head a new government in defeated France in 1940. But that government, which we call the Vichy government, because it's set up at the small town of, spa town of Vichy in central France. Why Vichy? Because there were lots of hotels, or the government could sort of could set up in these empty hotels. The tourists were pushed out, and for 4 years, Pétain is head of a kind of sort of puppet government, really, in Vichy, and he inaugurates a policy of what he calls collaboration with the Germans. And the absolutely emblematic image of that is Pétain meeting Hitler at a small railway station, Montoire, in October 1940. And there's this photograph of Pétain, the war hero of the First War, shaking the hands of the victor of the Second War, Hitler, saying we need to enter the road of collaboration with Germany. So the hero of the First War becomes the traitor of the Second War, because, of course, in 1944-45, the Germans are beaten, France is liberated, the new hero, General de Gaulle, arrives in power, and one of the first things that needs to be done is to make Pétain accountable for his actions between 1940 and 1944.
Okay. Well, yeah, that was, yeah, I was going to suggest that instead of Vichy, they should have set up their government in Avignon, you know, because of what happened, you know, another schism.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's the Vichy thing was very strange. I've often speculated if the same had happened to England, let's say the Germans across the Channel, could have happened, unlikely. What would our scenario? Let's say, you know, Churchill might have gone to America, like de Gaulle went to London to keep the fighter alive. There would have been a puppet government, possibly. Where would it have been? And I've often wondered whether it would be in the town of Bath or Harrogate, where they've got, you know, the waters, springs, you know, something. It's absurd as that, really, because Vichy had no historic importance. So Avignon would have, as you say, for the schism, the papal schism, as Avignon would have been a quite an amusing place for this slightly surrealist, you know, Ruritanian puppet government to set up.
All right. Well, okay, so now this is going to be the very long question, and because I've always wondered, never really was given information as to what was the purpose for him doing this. So here's the question. Why did Pétain collaborate with Nazi Germany? Was it A, France was defeated and resistance to Germany would lead to either further ruin or the deaths of innocent Frenchmen, therefore he had no choice because he lost his resolve and backbone? Was it B, France was defeated and resistance to Germany would lead to either further ruin or the death of innocent Frenchmen, therefore, this is kind of like the first question, but instead of saying he had no choice because he lost his resolve and backbone, this is more of he had no choice, but with strength and a strong resolve, he was willing to sacrifice his name, reputation, and life in order to get France through the storm. C, he saw communism as a threat, and that both Germany and Italy were the only reliable nations capable of stopping or defeating its spread, because as we know, the Spanish Civil War was quite a bit had to do with the spread of communism. D, he was pissed off at Britain for attacking the French fleet at Mers El Kebir. And E, the last one, he never cared for Britain in the first place, as he saw her as France's traditional rival and enemy. A perfect example of this would be the Fashoda crisis, when Pétain was 42 years old at the time and already serving as a French officer. What is your take?
Well, so it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 possible reasons for collaboration. I mean, my simple answer is I want to go back in way to the first one, particularly because your first one had the words, there was no choice, there was no alternative. He decided there was no alternative, so he needed to collaborate. So what I would say is that I think the explanation for what Pétain did is covered by all your questions. They all contain a bit of truth. They're all there. So it's not that there's one single reason. He didn't like communism. You're right. He didn't. He had lots of resentments against the British. You're right. All those things enter into it. So I don't think ever in history there's just one reason, you know, that explains something that is really complicated. But I really want to go back to the first question, where I think you said the words something like, he did it because there was no alternative, something like that. And then he felt that he needed to protect the French. And what I would say there is, in a way, that my book, which is about the trial of Pétain in 1945, which is looking at For 3 weeks, they were debating in the courtroom what his crime was, what he should be convicted of. And one of the things, of course, is were there alternatives? Were there things he could have done that he didn't do? And I think we need to begin with that. What was the alternative? Well, let's just look what the alternative might have been. Right. The French armies are defeated. No one denies that. Even de Gaulle in London knew the French armies were defeated. That's a point everybody agrees on. The question is, what does the French government do? You could say the French government is France. It speaks for the interests of France wherever the government might be abroad in exile, but there's a government. Now, when the war looked lost, the French Prime Minister, who had Pétain in his government, said what we should do is go abroad to North Africa, which was part of France, which was part of the French Empire. We should take the government to North Africa. We should take over as many of the many troops and much equipment as we can to North Africa, and we'll continue from there. We accept the army is defeated in France, but there's more. There's the world outside. And if the Germans come to North Africa, we'll go to London, which is what de Gaulle did. So there is an alternative. Now, you might say, or the defenders of Pétain would say, well, what would have happened to the people of France in France, right? Because if the government goes abroad, like the Dutch government, like the Norwegian government, like the Belgian government, if it goes abroad, the people of France are just left powerless, protectionless with the Germans. So the defense of Pétain would be, and that's your second point, I think, I sacrificed my reputation to try and be, and the word was used in the trial, a shield. That word came up a lot, a shield for the French against the Germans. Well, so there was an alternative and Pétain didn't take it. Now, had he taken it, what would have happened? Well, the Germans would have occupied the whole of French territory, whereas what happened in 1940 was the country was divided into two zones. There was a French zone and the other zone, the free zone of Vichy. And if the Germans had occupied the whole country, how would things have been different? Well, it's obviously a counterfactual question. You know, we don't know because we can't reinvent the whole history. But the honest truth is that if you look at what Vichy, the government of Pétain, did, it didn't really succeed in protecting the French from very much. Something like, I can't remember the figure off my head, but something like 500,000 French workers are sent to work in German factories. 75,000 Jews are deported from France in the war. So what kind of shield is that, really? So in a way, Pétain claims to be a shield, but it's more like a sieve than a shield, as somebody said at the trial. Even if that's what he thought he was doing, and even if you're right in saying, and what was influencing him sort of was the idea he didn't particularly like communism, the Germans had won, and so on. Nonetheless, it didn't work. And it's all very well to have good intentions, if they are good intentions, but if they fail, you have to be accountable, I think. And that was the view of the court in 1940. So I don't know whether that kind of answers your questions, because there were so many questions buried in your question. But I would say also that different people had different ideas behind collaboration. And for some of them, for his what you might call the sort of evil genius of Pétain, his prime minister, who comes amazingly to testify at the trial, he's taken refuge in Franco's Spain. More or less extradited. He comes back to suddenly he's there. And Laval's line is Germany's won the war. The war's over. The British will be defeated. The Soviets will be defeated. So it's a pragmatic, right, decision. We may not like the Germans, but we've got to do our best, if we're defending French interests, to do a deal with them. I don't think that was ever Pétain's. So Laval was quite pro-German. I don't think Pétain was. And another defense that was raised at his trial was, oh, actually, Pétain wasn't collaborating at all. He shook Hitler's hand, but behind Hitler's back, he was secretly negotiating with the British. There was a double game, right? That was one of the... So that wasn't on your list of questions, but it was one of the defenses put to the trial. Now, I think if you look at the truth, that's complete nonsense. There were occasional talks with the British, because obviously you always need to kind of protect your interests and so on. But there was no deal with the British. There was no double game. There was no secret game. Pétain had I think it is heart of hearts accepted that the Germans had won. You're right on that. And he had decided, and he had this idea that he was sort of sacrificing his honor to save the French. But I come back to, if you're in a courtroom, and that's the defense, and I then come back to say, okay, if that's your defense, what about the 500,000 workers who went to German factories? What about the huge quantities of material from German factories that went to, sorry, French factories that went to Germany, the huge amounts of agricultural products that were creamed off by the Germans, and the death of 75,000 Jews? What kind of protection is that? Is that an answer?
No, it is an answer, and it I mean, it makes sense. I wasn't sure, and I was trying to get into his shoes in from 36 to 39, and I'm thinking that he probably supported Franco during the Spanish Civil War. And, you know, I know 1940, you had the Japanese, they invaded French Indochina. And so, yeah, he kind of had his hands full. So, and then, you know, De Gaulle fought him in, I think, the French version of the Congo, and then they fought in French Lebanon and French Syria. So yeah, it was a big mess. And
but I think I just want to repeat, I think there were alternatives, and I think I also want to stress one thing, which is, you might say, well, honestly, if the government had gone abroad, what would it matter? It wouldn't have been a proper, it wouldn't have been, you know, it would have been a kind of rump government like the Belgian, right, like the Dutch that I mentioned earlier. But what's important is the fact that the government is abroad means that when the war is over, you don't feel that your national honor has been compromised and sullied. So although each country in Europe had to deal with condemning collaborators after the war, then that happened in all the countries of Western Europe. People were imprisoned and so on because of collaborating with the Germans. But the difference in France is it is actually the government. So it implicates in a kind of way the French in this operation. And that's why I think that whole memory, because my book's also about the very painful memory of these events after the trial, right up to the present. I mean, that even in the last presidential election in France, the Pétain came up because an extreme right-wing candidate wanted to argue that he helped to protect French Jews. But the reason why it's so much of a scar, and it's a scar as a civil war. I mean, I think it's a scar, I know it's not a good comparison to the American Civil War, but it is a civil war. It's a scar as real as the most intense civil war that any country can have. And that's because of that choice, which I think was a fatal choice.
Well, I know reading Churchill's biography, he was stating that it wasn't Pétain, I don't believe, but he offered the French leaders that Britain and France could become a union, and that they can just continue the fight to, move the government to England. It'll be one country, but they refused. And so, I mean, for me, it wasn't on Pétain; it was on the original leaders who surrendered.
Yeah, but no, absolutely. That was one of the defenses of Pétain at the trial. Well, you know, I wasn't the guilty one. I'm just a scapegoat for other people's guilt, that's a perfectly good argument, except that why did the government? So we'll go back to that moment, famous moment in June 1940, when the British, desperate to keep the French in the war somehow, offer this extraordinary, almost slightly crazy, fantastical proposal that two countries will become one. And amazingly enough, De Gaulle, nationalist of nationalists, actually backs this idea, but not because he believes in it really, but it's as a desperate attempt to keep the French in the war. Now you say, right, well, the French government turned it down, so why should we blame Pétain? But why did the French government turn it down? Because in the government was Pétain, and the prime minister of the time, who wasn't keen on this, who was keen on the Franco-British Union, who was really thought, oh, good, we've at last got, Churchill's given us a lifeline, a safety jacket, and this is our chance. But Pétain basically says, no, why would you attach yourself to a corpse? the British Empire. Why would we want to become a dominion, a minor dominion of the British Empire? So Pétain is, it's not that Pétain sort of takes over after that decision isn't taken. Pétain is part of that decision. Pétain is the man, and that comes up again and again at the trial. Pétain is the man with the most responsibility for the signing of the armistice. So if you're trying to sort of fight the trial with me here and be there, you're putting an argument that was put, but I think the counter argument there is quite effective. Some of the arguments against Pétain weren't, but I think that's effective. Without Pétain, there wouldn't have been an armistice. That's, I think, very clear.
Interesting. You know, even speaking of the trial and speaking of alternatives, even the defenders, there's a sticking point, and it's brought up a number of times in your book, that Pétain was, that he remained silent and did not change policies. This is one of the sticking points, that he remained silent, did not change policies, and turned to the Allies when the Americans landed in North Africa. Why do you think he didn't switch to the Allies, or at least step down and escape to join de Gaulle? And to an extent, if he had done that, that may have given some credence, whether it was real or not, of the double game between him and Britain.
No, that's a very important and good question. And it's sort of the million-dollar question, really. And for those who just those who don't know that background, because it's a really important moment that you picked on there. So basically, what happened in November 1942 was the Americans launched an operation against North Africa, French North Africa. That's to say Morocco, Algeria, and then Tunisia. And what the Americans were hoping, because as I'm sure you know, but it might be interesting for your listeners to know this, Roosevelt was always banking on the Pétain would, as it were, change sides. And Roosevelt had no time for Churchill. Roosevelt, the United States actually had an ambassador at Vichy from January 1941 right up to April 1942. And even after that, and the ambassador, Admiral Leahy, was a very close friend of Roosevelt. So Roosevelt didn't just send anybody. He sent somebody he really cared about. So Roosevelt was desperately hoping that Pétain could be pulled into the Allied camp. And that the moment of truth was obviously the moment you described. So American soldiers have landed in North Africa now, which is French. Will the Vichy troops fire on the Americans, or will they welcome them as liberators? Well, the first thing that the Vichy troops do is to fire on the Americans. And quite a number of, I don't know what number, but a number of American, it's a fairly quick operation, but a number of American soldiers are killed in those landings. But still, Pétain could have said, well, I had to do that to keep the Germans happy. But now I'm going to go to North Africa, rally the Allies, and bring France or North Africa back into the war. He doesn't do it. And for many people, and that's why you're absolutely right to pick on that moment, that was his crime. Because I begin my book by saying, okay, you're putting a man on trial, but what are you putting him on trial for? What is his crime? And de Gaulle thought the crime was to have signed an armistice on the 16th of June 1940. So he said that is the unacceptable thing. But other people felt, rather going back to the question I was asked earlier on, that, well, okay, the armistice, you know, somebody had to be there to look after the interests of the French people. So the armistice was defendable up to a point, but not after November 1942, when the Germans now occupy the whole of French territory. So you're not protecting the French because the Germans are everywhere. The Allies have occupied North Africa. So you're not protecting the empire because the empire is no longer French. So that's the moment for some observers that Pétain's crime is, that's where his crime, right, lies. And the answer, and you say why, and de Gaulle himself said, I cannot understand why Pétain didn't at that moment go to North Africa, because he could have become a hero. He could have entered, de Gaulle said he could have entered Paris on a white horse in 1944 at the liberation as a new hero, if at that moment he'd made that decision. But he didn't. He stays in Vichy. Now, defenders at the trial. It's a very complicated moment, but it's quite fascinating from the sort of detective story side of things, claim that Petter had actually sent secret messages, right, to his representative in North Africa, a man called Admiral Darlon. And the secret messages said, I publicly have to denounce the Americans, but actually I support you in doing a deal with the Americans and ending, you know, and allowing them, as it were, to install themselves in North Africa. So one defense is Petain was secretly, as it were, in support of the Americans, but he didn't want to say it openly because he didn't want to alienate the Germans, because that could have led to reprisals in France. That's one defense. It's really not very convincing if you look at the details of these messages and so on. So the question is still, why didn't he go to North Africa? And I think by then, he'd become a sort of prisoner of his own propaganda, you know, of his own myth. The thing that an earlier question asked me about Petain's sacrificial martyr victim. At the trial, some of his defenders said he was like a Christ-like figure with a crown of thorns, you know, sacrificing himself for humanity. And I think he made a famous speech in June 1940, where he said, je fais le don, I give the gift of my body to the, which is quite a religious idea, isn't it? I give the gift of my body to the French people. And I think he was still in that mindset, and he'd come to believe that he was a sacrifice, and he wanted to live out, you know, the role of sacrificial victim, if you want, for the French people. And then another more banal thing, he was an old man. One of the big questions of the trial is, you know, how much was Petain, he wasn't senile, but he obviously wasn't, you know, he was 89 years old. So when he's at Vichy, he's in his mid-80s. And think of that moment in November 1940, the Americans have landed, telegrams are flying between North Africa and Vichy, saying, what are we going to do? And Petain is really just sort of not really capable of taking any very proactive decisions, and hits his, let's go back to the, you know, the evil genius, if you want to call him that, Pierre Laval, who's very clear what he's got to do. You know, we've got to continue to stay with the Germans and so on. And so Petain sort of allows himself to be, he's pushed one way, he's pushed the other way. He's an old man, he's exhausted, and he doesn't have any longer, not so much the courage, but the vision to realize that his idea of himself as the sacrificial savior is just a myth. So, but again, your question is very important, because I think that is the key moment. And he could have saved himself. And his defenders at the trial said, actually, what makes Petain even greater for them is that at the moment he could have saved himself, he didn't save himself because he wanted to protect the French. But by November 1942, with the Germans entirely occupying France, what protection is he offering?
So the war was over in 1945. France was liberated, and the Nazis were defeated. Now, the trial against Petain was going to happen in absentia. But at the age of 89, Petain presented himself at the Franco-Swiss border so that he could personally stand trial.
Yep.
What was the reaction of the French, and de Gaulle in particular?
Basically, the last thing de Gaulle wanted was a trial. He wanted a trial in absentia without Petain being present. Because in 1944, Petain had been kind of kidnapped by the Germans, and he was kind of sort of taken to this weird kind of almost like Disney-like castle in Germany, where the Vichy regime lived out its last months in a kind of sort of weird, unreal rump government. And then, of course, Germany is defeated, and Petain, other people in his government are desperate to try and escape to it, well, somewhere, to Spain, just or Switzerland or wherever, to avoid facing the music in France. Petain is desperate to come back to France, and he gets admitted to Switzerland, but his condition is, I want to go back to France. And he presented himself on the French border in April 1945, the Franco-Swiss border. And that's exactly what de Gaulle didn't want. De Gaulle desperately wanted to have a trial in absentia. Why? Because he knew by definition the Petain trial would be immensely divisive. Because he knew that a lot of people still bought into the Pétain myth. They still kind of believed the propaganda. And so de Gaulle would have preferred a trial quick, no witnesses, you know, get it over and done with, and then Pétain dies quietly in exile and he causes no trouble. Pétain, clearly, you could say, well, why did Pétain want to come back? Why did he put himself through it? And I think because he honestly believed that the French believed that he was a kind of hero. He'd lived in a bubble of propaganda for 4 years, and I think he just believed his propaganda. And so he arrived back, and the other part of the question was, what did the French people think? Well, as you can imagine, the more sort of extreme members of parts of the resistance, particularly dominated by the French Communist Party, which is hugely important in 1944-45, they want Pétain prosecuted and they want Pétain shot. I mean, there's a lot of really violent anti-Pétain propaganda. I sort of produce in the book, but there could be many other examples of cartoons of Pétain, sort of, you know, with being guillotined, being hanged, and there are demonstrations all over the country, death to the traitor, that kind of thing. But there are other people who feel differently. So it's going to be a very divisive moment. And of course, what are the paradoxes of the trial? And what makes the trial quite sort of quite poignant in a way and difficult and mysterious is that having said he wants to come back and face the French people, Pétain then refuses to speak. His lawyer, partly his lawyer could see perfectly well that Pétain wasn't in a fit mental state to be able to for hours and hours a day under interrogation, being able to give a coherent account of what he did. So the lawyer's line was, Pétain will make an initial declaration. He will say, I do not recognize the authority of this court. I did my best to protect the French, et cetera, and I will not say another word. And for most of the trial, he did not say another word. And so what you have is this old man sitting in an armchair, sort of sometimes falling asleep, sometimes not sure what he's heard, what's being said. Sometimes he's cupping his hand over his ear because he's a bit deaf and so on. So you have this mystery at the heart of trial. What's going on in the head of the old man? And you have a paradox. The man who said, I want to come back and face the French people, doesn't really face the French people because he just keeps silent. So it is, it's a divisive moment, but it's a necessary catharsis. You couldn't not have had a trial of Pétain in 1940. There had to be a kind of lancing of the boil, if you want. Of course, it didn't do that because lots of people, because the defenders of Pétain thought he'd been unfairly treated and so on. So this rumbles on for 50 years, as I say in the third part of the book. But it was more than a show trial. There were 60 defense witnesses. You know, it was a real debate. But in the end, what is peculiar about it is the man who said, I'm going to come back and face the French people, sits there as a kind of silent, almost non-participant in his own trial.
You know, speaking of the Pétain declaration, that plays a significant role in the book. It plays a significant role in the trial itself, and I think it's something that is reverted back to. And I want to pull two quotes from the declaration. One quote is, history will reveal all that I spared you. All my adversaries only think of blaming me for what was unavoidable. And then he also says, what would have been gained in liberating a France in ruins, a France of cemeteries? Are those statements true? And did he, you know, like he, and I think to an extent it does come down to like what you just said, like he was a true believer in his own actions. But what has history revealed, from his decisions and how we see it now? And I will give a little super modern reference. My review of your book sort of lays it out to an extent of, man, what a difficult situation to be put in, and yet still people are still on both sides of accuser, defender, And then I read a review by The Guardian, and it was, Bataan needs a burn in hell for the rest of his life, you know? And it's like, man, like two opposite extremes. But what is history? What do you think history more accurately has revealed?
Well, I think history has now shown that it may not, you said, Pétain said, if I hadn't been there, France would have been liberated, would have been a country of ruins. Well, it was partly a country of ruins. I mean, it wasn't total ruins, but France was in a devastated state when it was liberated. There were, particularly in the north of France, where there'd been a lot of Allied bombing and the hunger of the population and so on, France was in a terrible state. Now, Pétain's claim, and this is, I think, the key thing, was that if I'd not been there, it would have been even worse. That's a sort of the point of your question. And the thing they kept saying is, I saved France from Polandization. What do they mean by Polandization? Well, that the Nazis basically completely, more or less, wiped Poland off the map. They treated the Polish population hardly better than the Jews, only one notch above the Jews. I mean, the Nazis believed that the Poles were subhuman, that Poland should disappear. They destroyed all the, they destroyed the country, basically. But it is, they had, in nowhere in Western Europe did the Nazis do the same. They didn't do that in Belgium. They didn't do that in Holland. They didn't do, obviously, occupation wasn't easy. But the Germans were, never had a plan to Polandize, if you want, France. So Pétain is saving France from a fate that was not, that wasn't going to happen, which isn't to say that in some ways things might have, we can't know. In some ways things might have been a bit worse or a bit better, we don't know. But in the end, that's a fantasy. And it was a fantasy. Another thing they said was Gauleiter. You know, the Germans had these officials called Gauleiters, who were sort of Nazi officials who were brought in to run occupied countries. And there were Gauleiters in Poland, and there were Gauleiters in Eastern Europe. There were no Gauleiters in Western Europe. The Nazis preferred in Western Europe to sort of work best they could through the local administration. They didn't want the trouble of putting in hundreds of thousands of troops. They needed them for the Eastern Front and so on. So I think when Pétain says, I saved you from being a country of ruins, I would say, well, up to a point, France was in the north, a country of ruins. And second, the idea that the ruins would have been so much worse is a fantasy, because that was never the idea of the Germans for Western Europe. So I think that defense just doesn't hold up. And that's what most historians would say now today.
So there was never a conversation taking place during the early occupation of, well, it looks like they are treating us very different than the countries of Eastern Europe. We can just go ahead and go, and things will not be any worse. Were there no conversations, or were there conversations had, and they're like, no, I have to stay?
Well, it's too late by then. But once you've taken the decision to be the government, then unless there's some major event, that's the decision. So you've taken the decision to be the government, and you're saying, well, if I weren't here, things would be worse. So it's always would be worse,
yeah,
which is how we come back to the counterfactual. So yeah, that's the argument. But once you've decided you're going to be the government, until a big event happens, you're not going to change. And the big event is one you referred to earlier, the Americans landing in North Africa in 1942. At that moment, there is a big event. And at that moment, for the reasons we explained earlier, I tried to explain earlier, the Pétain decided he didn't have the lucidity or the courage or the vision, whatever, to break with the policy, which had been his policy for 2 years.
So we mentioned earlier about the sword and the shield. Pétain stated that he was France's sword during World War I. He's become France's shield during World War II. I was struck in the book, after reading it, taking in the comments and testimonies of those who defended him and those who accused him, looking at then or now the poll results about people's view of potential, which I find so fascinating. Me too.
And I'm glad you picked up on that.
Yes.
Because a lot of people have read the book, obviously, but very few people, it's towards the end of the book, as you remember, when I kind of look at all the opinion polls that have been about Pétain since the liberation. And what I found was how remarkably not sympathetic but indulgent the majority of the population, they were sort of, when the question was, Pétain a traitor, should he have been shot or something like that, tiny percent say traitor. Was Pétain, sort of 7%, regularly about 7%. Was Pétain a hero? Again, tiny percentage, sort of, 7-8%. So they're two extremes, which are tiny. But most people situate themselves sort of in the middle, which is to say, okay, he did the best. He did what he thought was the best. The armistice was probably necessary, the things like that. And I am fascinated by that because it coexists with what the French now believe, and rightly believe, that the Vichy regime was massively complicit in the Holocaust. So since 1995, when the French president, Chirac, accepted responsibility for France in the Holocaust. Now, you might say, what does that mean? Basically, before then, people had said, well, what happened to the Jews in France was the fault of the Germans. So it wasn't France. Vichy had no choice. But Chirac said in 1995, no, Vichy, France was involved. It wasn't just France, it was Germany, but it was France. That was an extraordinary thing to say, extraordinarily important things to say. It's undoubtedly true. Yeah. And everybody, 90% of French people sort of believe that Chirac is right. And yet at the same time, they hold in their head another idea about Pétain. So, and you might say, explain it. And I can't explain it. Yeah. All I can say is, well, what I would say is it shows the sort of strange complexity and ambivalence and complication that the French have towards that period in their history. It's not resolvable, I think, really. It would be so much simpler if now everybody said, well, Pétain was guilty. But they say, yes, he was guilty, but he also did his best. So those polls for me are disturbing because they sort of don't fit into a simple narrative, but they are there. And my way of explaining them is to say that shows how much this event or these events of the occupation are still a burden, a moral burden, a burden for memory in France today.
Yeah, it's still something that it seems to be like it needs to be figured out. I don't think it will be figured out because here's the way I see it. And obviously you can correct me if my thinking is off. How Pétain is viewed today and how he was viewed then, it almost seems like, because there were other people who were put on trial, they were found guilty and they were executed.
Yeah. Yep.
Pétain was found guilty, but not executed. And there was a sympathy for him during his trial by a lot of people, not the communists. They wanted it like public.
And you should remember, the communists were not a tiny minority. The communists were probably 30% of the French population in 1944. I mean, this is we're not talking the extreme. We're talking really a huge, huge section of the resistance movements in 1940.
I think that's why de Gaulle was so nervous about Pétain coming in, is because he already knew it was going to be so difficult uniting the country. And with the rise of communism in France, is like, if this gets really bad, it's going to be even more difficult to unite and keep the communists from becoming more powerful. But what I see is Pétain is found guilty and yet not executed.
He is sentenced to death.
Right, he's sentenced to death, but they're like, he's an old man.
Exactly.
So he doesn't need to be killed.
Well, the jury voted by only one vote, actually, for the death sentence. But there were 24 jurors, and it was literally by one vote. But they also made a recommendation that, and the jurors, by the way, were former parliamentarians and former and resistors and so on. They were 12 resistors and 12 parliamentarians. They vote by this tiny, they're all convinced Petain is guilty, but they vote by a majority of one for death. But then they accompany this with a request that the death penalty not be carried out. And de Gaulle had never any intention of carrying it out. And that's for the simple reason. It would have been grotesque, really, to shoot a 90-year-old man who some people thought wasn't, you know, completely compost anyway. That would have been such a divisive thing to do. So what the government do is they send him to an island off the west coast of France. He's in prison, and they really hope he'll be forgotten. And he takes longer to die than people expected. He doesn't die till 1951. And then he becomes the sort of center of a kind of weird ultra-right cult. I mean, it is a small number. But underneath that cult, there is that sort of, what we talked about a moment ago, there is a sort of wider, a deeper, there's a sort of it flourishes on a body of people who think, okay, you know, he did his best and so on. So it feeds off that.
And I think that's sort of the reflection that you see now is what took place is not carrying out the execution is a sense of mercy, leniency, however you want to view it. And even in today's, like, the poll numbers that you present, is people are like, yes, he shouldn't have done what he did. But at the same time, there is, and it's like he was guilty of what he did for sure. But then there's also that sense of mercy and leniency that people have toward him.
No, I think because I think ambivalence is the word. Yeah. And complexity. I mean, I've used these words again and again, but I think that there is no simple view of Petain. There is no simple view of Petain, and I suppose that's why perhaps he's not so much a tragic hero as a tragic villain in a way. So it is, and I think I completely agree with all that, and that you won't find many people, you know, if asked today, just straight out, what do you think of Marshal Petain? It'll be generally negative. But then if you ask another question, did he do his best for France? Well, yeah, probably did, etc. So and I think for me, that's why it goes on, not just Petain, but because of the ambivalence about Petain, there remains this scar that is the occupation. The occupation is a scar in French history. It's a fault line. There's a sense of shame. There's a sense which people don't really want to think about.
Yeah. This question, when I was reading your book, there was this theme going throughout it. And I've really looked forward to asking this question. It's going to be my last question. I'll let Alan ask his last question. But you refer to a dispute Petain and de Gaulle had about the hierarchy of honor and life.
Yep.
So de Gaulle believed that honor was to be preserved over life, and Petain believed the opposite. Now, I will posit in that if the conversation were to be placed here in America, I think our hierarchy would ascend to liberty. It's the whole give me liberty or give me death approach. Nonetheless, at that point, how do we judge correctly the decisions people in power like Petain make if they are based on ideals?
Well, if we go back to what it's that particular dispute you raised, it comes up in the 1930s, because de Gaulle and Petain, we must remember, they knew each other. What they'd known each other since the First World War. De Gaulle had been a very, very junior soldier at Verdun. So he'd served under Petain in 1914, 15, and 16. And then after the war, because Petain is aware that de Gaulle is a very brilliant writer and so on, Pétain kind of hires de Gaulle to be a kind of almost like a ghostwriter for a book that Pétain is writing on the French army. And there's this passage when de Gaulle, when Pétain is, has drafted a no, de Gaulle, sorry, has drafted a passage saying, oh, in the revolution, the soldiers, French soldiers, lost, as you, in that phrase that you quote, they lost life, something, dignity, life, and honor. But honor is the last word. And Pétain changes it to whatever, dignity, honor, life. And de Gaulle corrects Pétain, yeah, saying, but no, this is an ascending trilogy. Between life and honor, honor is, as it were, the most important. And what's extraordinary about that little dispute between two writers, if you want, in 1935 or 36, is that you could say the whole of the debate between Pétain and de Gaulle in 1940 is around that idea. De Gaulle, if you know, I wrote a book on de Gaulle, which was called A Certain Idea of France, and that comes from de Gaulle's own war memoirs, which begin with the words, all my life, I've had a certain idea of France. And that's about what France should be in the world. France is not France if she's subservient, subordinate, and all those things. Pétain, however, so de Gaulle goes, leaves the soil of France, if you want, in 1940, to take France with him to London. Now, that's not because he's kind of mad and he thinks he is France. He thinks he's simply doing it because he says somebody has to represent the idea of this great nation abroad. Pétain, who comes from a very peasant background, is worth it's worth remembering. He comes from, you know, very modest agricultural Pétain, a peasant family in the north of France. Pétain is a man who's saying, no, to defend France, you have to be on the soil of France. France is the soil, is the people, etc. De Gaulle in his war memoirs actually says sometimes the French aren't worthy of France. He actually says, if there's a choice, sometimes it's France you choose over the people. So it's a fascinating debate in a way, and it's unresolvable. It's a different, you might say, vision. But what I would say is, in the end, if Pétain said, I'm staying to defend the French, and de Gaulle said, I'm leaving to defend France, de Gaulle certainly succeeded in defending France, in the sense that when he comes back to France in 1944, thanks to de Gaulle, France is almost seen as a as one of the winning powers. France has a zone of occupation in Germany. France has a permanent seat on the UN Security Council, which he got in 1945. So miraculously, the country that has been humiliated in 1940 is among the victors. It's a bluff. I know, but it's nonetheless symbolically important. So, but Pétain says, no, I'm staying to defend the French. Well, I would say de Gaulle succeeded in defending France for reasons I've just said. But in the end, did Pétain defend the French? I don't think it goes back to what we've been saying a lot. I don't think he did. I think the fate of the French was pretty bad. And I know we can't know whether or not it would have been worse, but we can certainly say it was bad. So you could say de Gaulle, if you take those two positions, which are, as you know, absolutely intellectually opposed, de Gaulle sort of succeeds in his, and I don't think Pétain, you could say Pétain's is perfectly a respectable position. We care about lives.
Yeah.
But in the end, it's not one that he succeeds in carrying out.
Yeah, that's the crux of it.
That's the crux. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I sort of, when I was reading it, I saw it in a three-pronged way. Like, okay, I can identify with both of them in the argument. Because it's like de Gaulle's like, what's the point in having life if you don't have any honor? And Pétain's like, well, you can't have honor if there's nobody alive. And from my perspective with America, it's like we would do the same with liberty. Like there's no point in being an American or being alive if you don't have liberty. There's no point in living without freedom. And it's the fight that comes down to it. And to your point is like, yes, Pétain may have had the right idea, but the execution did not work. It didn't pan out. And for de Gaulle, it did. But I just, man, it was just so fascinating that tied into not just them individually. But it was, it tied into the trial itself. And then it ties into, how the French view things, now. And at the same time, it's a very, I don't want to say metaphysical, but it's almost a metaphysical view. And I think somebody says that during the trial, or one of the,
they do.
Journalists.
And somebody says, this is partly a metaphysical debate. There are no right or wrong answers. There's a very interesting quotation from a journalist who says precisely that.
Yeah.
Everybody has their reasons, kind of thing. So, yes, and that's what makes... For me, the trial, it's not, some of the questions we've just been talking about, you just raised, aren't just questions, as you rightly say, about France. They're big questions, really, about how individuals and nations view themselves.
Yeah, I see. And that's one of the things that I love about the book, is that it's not strictly about this four-year period. These are eternal questions that have to be addressed. I would hope by everybody. Like, these are questions that you have to think about. And it's not solely about Pétain, the French, the Germans. These are eternal questions.
And the way you said an American author or listener would not necessarily pose, the words wouldn't be honor in life, liberty in life. I totally see that. But in a sort of way, the word honor that de Gaulle used is a slightly old-fashioned word. It's a very military word. We all, one believes in honor, but it's not a word so much that people use today. It's very much of that period. But I think by honor, he meant a lot of the things that you're including in liberty, by which he meant, how can you have the dignity of a free man if you're living in an occupied country? So when he talked about honor, it's not just some old fashioned military thing. It's also about human dignity, and liberty and human dignity is surely absolutely linked in the Americans. The American sense of liberty is also about the dignity of the individual. And I think de Gaulle, that was also part of de Gaulle's vision. I totally agree with you. Why I think the trial of Pétain, and why what trying to do with the book was to write a very intense, almost theatrical, almost like a novel, almost like a play account of three very specific, very dense days in a very complicated courtroom. But for me, I hope that people enjoyed the book for the story it tells, but the big point was exactly what you've said, that out in that courtroom are being discussed not just issues about France, but really about they are big, as you quite rightly say, metaphysical questions.
Yeah, to an extent, it could be instead of France on trial, the world on trial. At the end of your work, you mentioned the rise of counterfactual history. Yeah. You mentioned it a moment ago. Where are you seeing this, and how is it a problem in the short term and the long term?
I don't really see it as a problem. I'm sure you know that there are some historians who have always played with counterfactual history. The what if? One counterfactual you could say is, if the British had been defeated in 1940, which could have happened, would we have seen some of the same things we saw in France? Would we have had a Vichy government? Would we have had collaborators? The British like to think, no, we would never have been like the French, etc. But the counterfactual is to try and work out what would have happened if. Now, obviously, there are problems with if questions, because historians are supposed to understand or try to understand what did happen, and they're not novelists, or they're not fantasists. But I think you can say that often a historical question, a question a historian tries to answer, does sort of contain a hidden counterfactual. So if you say, an event X was caused by Y, what you're actually saying is, if Y hadn't happened, X wouldn't have happened. So you're by saying, because historians are always saying X caused Y, know, this caused the Second World War, that, etc. So the moment you do that, you are kind of saying, I can also imagine a world in which the causal wasn't there. So there's often, do you see what I mean, a kind of implicit counterfactual. Now, one mustn't get over, one mustn't push this too far, but those historians who write, who are interested in counterfactual history, and there was the historian Niall Ferguson, for example, wrote a book, I think it was called Virtual History. And it was a collective volume, and he got a number of historians to do a what if, you know, what if this, what if this, etc. I think, you know, one of them was, what if the South had won the American Civil War? What if the British had been defeated in 1940? That's a long trip. What if Wellington had won the Battle of, what if Napoleon had won the Battle of Waterloo? That kind of thing. What if? But what he says in a sensible introduction is sort of massively speculative what ifs aren't particularly interesting. But where there's a plausibility, you just need to turn the dial a tiny little bit and the what if is plausible, then it's worth doing. And it works for France in 1940 because there was a big debate in the government in 1940, to go back to the beginning of our conversation, about whether or not to sign an armistice with Germany or to go to North Africa. And it turned on very little. So given that that was an option that was really debated and was possible, it's not invalid, I think. It's what you could call a plausible counterfactual. You know, not what if suddenly, I don't know, the Americans had sent the French hundreds of thousands of weapons or something. Yeah, that's imaginary, but that's a plausible what if. And it's worth playing with. And it's worth playing with, particularly if you're doing a book like my book was, because it was about a trial, and a trial was about offering a defense. And one of the defenses was, this couldn't have happened, or this could have happened. Petain couldn't have gone to North Africa because this would have happened, this would have happened, and this. So it's worth playing a little bit with it, but you have to be careful, because once there is actually a quite amusing volume done by three not sort of professional historians, they're amateurs, but you know, people really interested in you know, history blogs, not serious books, where they sort of do the whole course of the Second World War, three volumes, 40, 41, and I think 42, they do three volumes, and they imagine, right, if the French had gone to North Africa in 1940, how would the war be different? Now, the further down the path you go, the less plausible it gets, because there's so many variables, you know, more and more and more variables you have to keep changing. But if you're just at the beginning of the event, I think it's a useful, you could say it's a game, it's a useful sort of tool to test alternatives and to test, and particularly, as I say, when we're, what we're doing here is trying, you know, a man for treason, that what they were doing. And I think in that case, it's worthwhile for the historian, as it were, to play with the arguments that were for and against, and to see what the alternatives were. But we mustn't go too far, obviously, down the what if, because it can then become, it just becomes a completely uninterestingly speculative, not historical, maybe fun, but it's not historical.
Right. Yeah. And it can wind up having you, leading you to have sympathy for the devil.
And, yeah.
Julian, this has been so fun. I knew it was going to be a fantastic conversation, and incredibly enlightening. But thank you so much for the work that you do. I can't recommend enough your France on Trial. It was so good, for so many different reasons. But thank you again for joining us on the podcast. We've thoroughly enjoyed having you, and thank you for all your work.
Well, no, thank you, because what I appreciate is not only your questions, but the review you did. There've been lots of reviews, and most of them have been positive. But usually they don't really you feel they haven't properly read the book. And yours is one where it was not only positive, but there was a nice one also in the New York Review of Books this week, which is a very long one, where it was clear that it was very positive, but he'd read the book, clear you'd read the book. And it's actually nice. The nicest thing, well, no one wants to get bad reviews, but then no one particularly likes to get a good review where the person hasn't, you know, they're just saying that you don't feel they've actually engaged with the book. The nicest is you get a good review that also seems to like the book for the reasons you thought you had written it. And I thought you did that. So thank you very much.
Well, I'm glad that you said that, and I appreciate that.
Okay, well, thank you for having me. Anyway, thank you.
Well, that was absolutely fascinating. As fascinating as I had hoped that it would be. What an honor to have Julian on the show. And who is Rick Steves?
Oh, yeah. Well, when you butchered his honors earlier in the show, I went and grabbed, you know, I took this with me. You know how people say that French are rude and all that? They're actually pretty cool. You just have to carry around a book like this and let them know that you're making an attempt to speak French and they'll love you. But yeah, I recommend this book and recommend it whenever you're trying to announce a person's official title and honors and all that. But anyway, back to the show, man.
Hey, man, it's the R's. It's the R's that really cause me problems with the French language.
Yeah, and the T's and the D's and the everything else. So
it's so very different world, man.
Yep. So
it's only a channel separating the two, but man, it's so very different.
Right. Very, very, very interesting conversation. You know, with my parents having been born in French colonies during World War before. Well, my mom during World War II, my father before World War II. You know, for me, it's always I always like listening to stories about you know what went on during that time during the colonial era, and you know. I kind of feel bad for Pétain because for me, it's like, what else could he have done?
And that's why I think it's very important for people, if they really want to know what happened, you really need to go buy this book, France on Trial.
Yeah, I didn't want to say this to him because, you know, we're trying to have an intellectual conversation. But, you know, I'm a big fan of Battlestar Galactica also. And when Boltar... It kind of reminds me when Boltar was the president and the Cylons showed up. He was later put on trial for collaborating with them. But Apollo was like, you know, what else could he have done? Everybody would have been killed. What would you have done? You know, so that's kind of how I looked at Pétain.
Well, leave it to you to bring in Battlestar Galactica. Yeah, well, ladies and gentlemen, that is a theme that has run through a bit of our 200 plus episodes is Alan. Oh, he loves to let everybody know, hey, I'm a big fan of Battlestar Galactica.
Hey,
can't do it.
Got them,
can't do it.
Got
won't
them
do
right
it.
Here.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we hope that you enjoyed this episode. We hope that you enjoy the rest of your week, and we will see you next week for our very last episode of the Sons of History podcast. We'll see you then.